From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. First CMU, then Uber, and now Ford invests $1 billion in the autonomous vehicle industry in Pittsburgh.
Our goal is to be able to start looking at how we not only do the R&D and testing, but the manufacturing side.
Will Pittsburgh be the center of self-driving vehicles? Also, a new report recommends giving youth greater say in the shaping of the juvenile justice system.
The highest priority recommendation was to really focus on issues of disproportionate contact of youth of color in the system, with a particular focus on supporting young girls.
And business is booming in Harrisburg for political action committees, lobbyists, and others. A new look at campaign funding. We'll discuss all of that on our weekly news roundup. The Confluence follows this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up later in the program, a report by the Pittsburgh Foundation recommends giving youth more of a say in shaping the juvenile justice system, especially those already in the legal system. But first, there was a lot of buzz in the fall for the worldwide debut in Pittsburgh of self-driving cars by Uber. But now comes word that Ford is investing $1 billion in Argo AI, a Pittsburgh company, to develop self-driving cars for the company, Ford, by 2021. Joining us in studio to discuss this, Tim Schooley, real estate reporter for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Welcome back to the show, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
And Ed Blazina, reporter covering transportation for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Good to have you here as well.
Thanks so much.
Okay, let's start with that date, 2021. Doesn't sound that far off. What are we really talking about by that 2021 date? We'll start with you, Ed.
I think what Ford hopes to do is have a vehicle ready for sale to the public. And that's a very fast timetable. We'll see whether they can meet it or not. They're going to invest $1 billion here over the next 5 years into putting together that brain for the car to make it run by itself without a driver having to actually physically control it.
Do you agree, Tim?
That sounds about right. I mean, it does seem like an aggressive time frame, but obviously we have Uber testing these cars on our streets right now. So that's, you know, if they're doing it now, it's not implausible that they could meet that kind of a time frame.
They don't really have to make a new car per se. Is it just the manufacturing of the brain and then outfitting, as you alluded to, Ed, you know, the brain, and then just sort of simple definition, attaching it to the car?
That's my understanding. There will have to be some adaptations to the vehicle to accommodate, but that's essentially what they need to do is perfect the brain.
Okay. Who is Argo AI?
That was an interesting reaction from Rich Fitzgerald the other day at an event. He was like, we don't even get to know who these people are, and Ford's coming in investing $1 billion in them. It's a couple younger guys who have been working with Google on their self-driving car project and at Uber. And it's hard not to think of Ford's investment in this as a big move to encourage talent to join them as they build this out. So that'll be interesting to watch.
It seems very much tied to that talent pool from Carnegie Mellon.
My understanding is that Argo is led by two alums of CMU's National Robotics Engineering Center.
Actually, I think the top five people there.
Mm-hmm. Argo does have a website. Their CEO's biography said he actually was a Pitt grad.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Pitt slid into
with
CMU folks.
That's what it said. I'll even verify that as we speak. But he was certainly involved with CMU and NREC as well. And he sounds like he's obviously very well thought of if Ford is going to make this kind of investment in them.
Okay, so Ford's going to make this investment. So what is Argo going to do with this $1 billion?
They're going to build the brain. I keep going back to that,
right.
but that's the key to the whole thing, is getting the technology right so that it works with the cars.
So how much is out there in terms of building brains? How much is already there? They're not necessarily starting from scratch, are they? What needs to be done? And because there's already something out there, is that why this time frame is possible?
Yes, indeed. What they have is Uber is already testing its cars, so there is a format out there. These folks are being hired to perfect something that can then be sold to the public. Uber isn't ready to sell its product to the public yet. They're still testing. They're doing mapping, getting everything prepared.
Mm-hmm. Tim? It's obvious that, I mean, this is a company that no one had really heard of before a week and a half ago, and now suddenly they're having this kind of investment. So obviously Ford thinks that these guys can take them a long way to get them caught up on this technology.
Is that sort of surprising that, you know, general public doesn't know about these guys, but the people with the money who are ready to invest a lot of money, they've been keeping their eyes on, and if they want to be just like the other large auto makers, if they want to get into this field, they have to have been keeping a close eye on these human brains, shall we say.
It's been a industry in which there's been a fair amount of secrecy for understandable reasons. So it's pretty natural that we wouldn't necessarily know who a lot of these people are. Uber's been fairly quiet in fits and starts, and then they come out and have these charm offensives. But obviously, this is a very competitive campaign by an industry to ramp up. The right people are well known, but not necessarily to the rest of us, I would think.
And it seems as if what they're doing is cannibalizing each other. I mean, somebody comes up with the next project, they go and hire from the same pool of talented people who can do that work.
Yeah, because didn't some of these guys work, I believe, for Google or Uber?
Yes.
Right, there's a couple of people who came directly from Uber. And obviously Uber has only been here, I mean, they really only opened the ATC within the last 6-9 months. So it's not like they're an old-timer in town. But
right, but when they came, there were lots of reports of them taking a lot of talent from CMU, and oh my, what was CMU going to do? Well, CMU has gotten along just fine because there seemed to be plenty of people available.
Because CMU has the reputation, they attract, and then people leave, they spin off companies, and it just seems to be almost circular. They just keep attracting more talent to then develop stuff for the private sector.
That's the way they say it's supposed to work.
We're talking about $1 billion investment by Ford in Argo AI, a Pittsburgh company, to develop self-driving cars for the company by 2021. Our guests are Tim Schooley, real estate reporter and covering other issues for the Pittsburgh Business Times, and Ed Blazina, reporter covering transportation for the Post-Gazette. I was talking to Mayor Peduto about Uber and autonomous vehicles last week, right before this announcement came out, and at that time he told me that they really want to make sure that this region goes beyond the research and development in the Pittsburgh area.
Our goal is to be able to start looking at how we not only do the R&D and testing, but the manufacturing side. And with the $253 million grant we received last month from the Department of Defense, we'll have the Autonomous Manufacturing Center for America right here in Pittsburgh.
Okay, Ed, you want to respond to what the mayor said? He was talking about, the mayor was talking about, okay, we want to not just do R&D, we want to build things.
That's the key. You know, $1 billion sounds like a lot that Ford's investing, and it certainly is more money than you and I will ever see. But the big enchilada is the manufacturing and the other work that comes with this. They're going to hire 200 folks initially at Ford. The mayor wants them to hire thousands of people doing the construction and manufacturing of these components.
So it's important to have that manufacturing center because even if software and ideas, the R&D is done, whether it's done locally or somewhere else, if then they have to apply that R&D to manufacture and that manufacturing center is here, this region still benefits. Tim?
Right. I guess the big question we'll have to see is how Ford views the need for that within the context of all its manufacturing facilities.
And you were mentioning 200 jobs, and those weren't necessarily 200 jobs in the Pittsburgh region. That was in a variety of cities, I believe.
Michigan and California as well, but it's expected that the vast majority of them would be here.
Okay. So what are these jobs? Do we know exactly how much will be sort of, dare I say, hands-on making, how much will be in R&D and the sort of creating the ideas? Do we know how that might be broken down yet?
I think there's every expectation that a lot of this is R&D at the beginning.
But what about the actual making? Do we know anything just yet, or is it still too early in the story?
I'm assuming it's going to be R&D as well. I'm looking at the lists of positions they have right now on their website. There's robotic systems, robotics planning and controls, machine learning, head of partnership and strategy, computer vision. So it sounds like it's going to be, it's probably going to somewhat mirror what Uber's been doing in terms of the people that they've had.
Mm-hmm. The mayor mentioned in that little sound clip that we heard just a little bit ago, he was referencing the $250 million grant from the Department of Defense in Carnegie Mellon's Advanced Robotics Manufacturing Institute in the city. I want to get you guys to sort of say, well, there's been a variety of announcements or developments over really a short period of time, whether it was the debut that I mentioned earlier, Uber and the self-driving vehicles. We were getting attention from around the world, Pittsburgh, for these demonstrations, to the USDOT Department of Transportation designating Pittsburgh as one of the 10 testing grounds nationwide for autonomous vehicles, to this $250 million grant, to now the Ford investment of $1 billion. This has been really happening quite quickly.
It certainly has. It's exactly what I wrote about in Sunday's Post-Gazette, was how these things have all come together at one time.
So what started this? What is it, just dominoes? Because they can't be separate. They have to be seen. And obviously Ford's announcement, they weren't going to say, oh, the U.S. Department of Defense is investing $250 million in this. Oh, let's throw in $1 billion. They had to be thinking about this for quite some time.
Very, very much so. But the mayor traced it back to CMU's decision back in the mid-'80s to concentrate more heavily on artificial intelligence, and how now that is circling back and starting to pay off.
And the payoff is happening now, Tim? I mean, over the course of really a handful of months that we're seeing these major developments.
Yeah, Andrew Moore, who leads the computer science school at CMU, has said, and others have backed him up, that Pittsburgh is one of four cities in the world with the capabilities surrounding artificial intelligence, robotics, and related industries. They're among the four top cities anywhere that you can find in the world. And this industry is just beginning to coalesce into a real commercialization now, and Pittsburgh is benefiting from that.
I want you to repeat that. You said, you didn't say four in the nation. You said four in the world.
Right. Four in the world.
Any others in the U.S.?
Silicon Valley.
Of course.
I think, I can't remember if Boston might have been included.
Okay, so most of them are still in the U.S.
Yeah.
The majority. Okay.
Right.
So, and I wanted to ask you about this Ford thing. I mean, do we know how far back they've been thinking about this? One would think that they were keeping their eye on and exploring autonomous vehicles for quite some time because they want to still be viable in the decades to come. But as far as this investment, did we get any hint of that when they announced it?
The mayor says they've been having discussions behind the scene for more than a year. He said he actually wanted them to be part of the smart cities proposal that they made, where they were going for $50 million from the U.S. Department of Transportation for smart cities, which has to do more with traffic and that kind of development. And Ford just wasn't ready at that time, so they did not include them. Pittsburgh wasn't successful in that, but they've still gotten a lot of federal Department of Transportation money for some of the things they were proposing in that area.
Speaking of the Smart Cities Challenge, that's one of the things he's been upset with Uber about, not being part of that proposal since they were already here in there and not willing to be a participant in that challenge. That's sort of upset him in saying, and sort of challenging Uber to step up and meet the city's requests like the city's been meeting Uber's requests. Tim, you're shaking your head. Yes.
I thought Uber had some involvement. There were so many different companies and agencies involved in that application. Uber certainly could make a big difference if they hadn't. But obviously, the city is moving in that direction with these smart technologies anyway. And they did get, CMU did get a nice grant from the federal government to work on mobility transportation issues. So it wasn't a total loss either. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, these companies are setting up here. So it's an interesting hotbed for all this.
But you're right. The mayor is not happy with Uber's participation there. I think he feels like he has bent over backwards for them, and perhaps they're not bending as far towards some of the things he'd like to see.
Well, I want to follow up on something that you had said earlier regarding Uber that they weren't ready yet to sort of take this next step to sort of put the cars on the market. So is this a challenge to them? Might this decrease their interest in the Pittsburgh area? What do you think this could do regarding Uber?
It'll be interesting to see. $1 billion sounds like a lot of money to invest in this. Uber has already invested probably far more than that. So we'll see how quickly Ford can catch up to where Uber is at already. And we'll see. Uber plays things very close to the vest. We don't know for sure whether Uber has any plans on trying to sell self-driving vehicles or not. They may just want to sell the technology. It's not clear yet what they want to do.
You know, a lot of this is, I guess, speculation, but we hear anything about, okay, sell the technology to whom? To Ford? To Art? I mean, who's out there to buy it? To another major car manufacturer?
Exactly. There are bunches of car companies in Detroit that are interested in this. Not all of them have put as much money into it as Ford has. Ford seems to be trying to take the lead in developing the technology so that they can then license it to the others.
In our final minute, gentlemen, I want to get hear from both of you. Do we know, have any next steps been outlined yet for this investment? Okay, we have this, the announcement is made, so what are the next steps going to be made by Argo AI? Do we know that yet?
I'm hearing kind of rough, unconfirmed word that they may have established a small office in the Strip District, but it sounds like they're still trying to figure out what they want to do. From everything I heard, everything's pretty preliminary.
Ed, anything from you?
Yes. My colleague Mark Balco wrote a story this week that they are looking for office space, and lots of folks would like to give them space for whatever they need. It's not clear whether they want just offices or a bigger facility like Uber has where they can do some testing, et cetera.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so very much. Ed Blazina is a reporter covering transportation issues for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Tim Scully is a reporter for Pittsburgh Business Times. Gentlemen, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A new report recommends including the input of youth already in the legal system in ways to reform the juvenile justice system. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Foundation released a report this week about the juvenile justice system and made some recommendations, such as giving youth, those already in trouble with the law, more of a say in shaping the juvenile justice system. Joining us to talk about this is Joyce Gannon, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Joyce. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And also Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Tribune Review. Welcome back, Natasha.
Thanks. Good to be here.
If you have a comment or question, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Ladies, some background. Why was the study done in the first place? More young people entering the legal system? Someone took notice that there's a racial disparity of those already in the system. So why, Joyce?
It started, Kevin, as a initiative from the Pittsburgh Foundation, which is pursuing what they're calling a new grant-making strategy called 100% Pittsburgh. And they're trying to target why so many people in the region are living in poverty, even as our economy is starting to eke out some gains. So they're targeting two specific sectors. One is youth from 12 to 24 years old who have a great risk of being in poverty, and also single women who have children. This particular study that we're talking about today was their first study, and they looked at those who are in the juvenile justice system and why that's puts those kids at risk for poverty.
Natasha?
And one of the things about should be noted about this particular report is that it wasn't a quantitative report. It did incorporate data for context, but the data was more, based on previous studies that have been done. This was a qualitative study And that was because they really wanted to focus on listening to the youth themselves. It may sound like a simple concept, but they really, part of what this report concluded is that really to improve the system, we need to do a better job of listening to the youths who find their way into the system, who are on probation, what their experiences are. And one of the key findings was that we aren't doing enough to look at what the root causes, the key things that really are disrupting their home lives and perhaps leading to the circumstances that cause them to act out and get deferred to the system. Because as one student or as one juvenile probation put it, you know, it's so easy to get in the system and so hard to get out.
Okay, I'm going to take a look at the recommendations a little bit later. So these were the juveniles who were interviewed, were spoken with, currently in the system, formerly in the system, both, Joyce?
Both. They've all had experience with the system, either themselves and now they're in some kind of counseling program, or family members. And what the foundation researchers went to various agencies and experts who work with these children. Mm-hmm. And then they gained access to the kids themselves instead of just talking to, you know, the probation officers and the agencies. They got in and had actual conversations with 53 different children.
Mm-hmm. The lead researcher, Michael Yonis, told us that they also, in addition to the young people in the juvenile legal system, they also talked to youth advocates, service providers, and some data experts.
What we heard from the groups, but then most of all the young people, is that they want to have more voice, more involvement in their experiences and in sort of the decisions that affect their lives. And in many cases, coupled with that, it's, you know, young people saying it's so hard to get out of the system.
And that sort of echoes what you just said, Natasha. And I'd like to follow up on that. And easy to get in, difficult to get out, but also isn't that, okay, difficult to get out of the juvenile system, but then it's also easier to get into the adult legal criminal system, I guess, as well.
Right. There's a strong correlation, yeah, between having, you know, contact in the system when you're younger and as well as an adult. And as a lot of kids describe it, as sort of this kind of downward spiral that maybe begins with something really simple. You know, I'm reading from the reports from one of the kids, one of the youths told researchers, kids can get in trouble for smaller things that add up, like possession of weed or missing school. And then eventually they are just looked at as criminals and end up on probation. I also talked to one of the people who helped participate in this, Tiffany Sizemore Thompson, who she works at the Duquesne University's Juvenile Defender Clinic. And she had she's seen in her own experience how a dime bag of weed can derail a child's entire education, academic career. And, you know, the research shows if you start, you know, you missing school, having problems, you could have a harder time getting to college, you could have a harder time finding jobs, even going to the military could be no longer an option for these children.
Right. And a lot of kids that were interviewed for this report and a lot of kids that are in the system start out in a cycle of poverty. So I'm quoting some of what they told the researchers, that, you know, they didn't have food in the house, so they went out and stole. If they weren't in school, nobody was home. They're children of single parents.
Okay.
I think it should be worth pointing out that the data does show that 73% of referrals made to the Allegheny County Office of Juvenile Probation were for nonviolent crimes such as drugs, theft, and failing to pay court fines. That was seen as another thing that sometimes kept kids in the system longer than they should be, just by nature being poor and unable to pay restitution and court fees. That can keep them in the system longer as well. And they also point out that it's schools that are doing some of the most reporting and referrals, and there's kind of a wide range of, you know, maybe how schools might choose to handle a particular case with one student and can have really, you know, extreme consequences.
We mentioned the lead researcher just a moment or so ago, Michael Yonis. He also said when they were talking to, I believe it was 53 young people, they just wanted to be asked why.
Like, why are they engaging in this behavior? Why are some of the, why are they skipping school? And others not just respond to their behavior, but really respond to the why and to get deeper into that to better understand those factors that are affecting them.
Did we get a sense from this report or in talking to anyone that that they were actually shocked that somebody did ask why? You know, somebody cared enough to ask why this all started, this cycle?
Oh, I believe that from talking to some of the agencies that work with these children. And I also talked to Tiffany Sizemore, who Natasha also interviewed at Duquesne. And it was interesting because Kathy Elliott, who runs an agency called Gwen's Girls.
Named after Gwen Elliott.
Her mother.
Right.
Right.
Police
very,
commander.
Very renowned advocate. Kathy said that, you know, when the researchers came over to Gwen's Girls, she and her staff stayed out of the room. And they let the girls talk directly without any interference from adults. And then when I was talking to Kathy, she said, really, we should have been doing this all along. It's a no-brainer. Talk to the kids, find out why some of these things happened and what we should be doing to help them.
I want to talk about where it starts. And Josh, you brought up before poverty being a key factor in here. And oftentimes the issue, the troubles start in school or around school. That term school-to-prison pipeline has become more widely known over the last several years. Get into trouble at school, maybe you skip school chronically, you get suspended out of school, so maybe you get into a little more trouble because now you're out of school suspended. And also, if you're out of school, you're more likely to not graduate. If you're more likely not to graduate, then you're more likely to get into the criminal court system. So the question about the initial trouble, how it's handled, and is that addressed in this report, how the initial trouble is handled so it doesn't spiral into something or spiral down to something more serious?
Well, one of the recommendations definitely is to reform school discipline policies and take a closer look at that very process. Because as you point out, I think one of the things that the data does show that is concerning is that this does start very young. Data shows that as young as preschool, Black youths get suspended at 4 to 5 times the rates, sometimes of whites. That's, you know, a statistic from Pittsburgh Public Schools.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, there are data to show for similar offenses, you know, kids whose students are getting treated differently. So I think, the schools have said they are addressing that to some degree. Part of the problem is there may be some complex factors going on here. You know, we're not saying maybe that teachers are purposefully making this happen, but what are the different factors at play that are contributing to this concerning factors? Because if you start getting suspended from school and preschool, I mean, most of the data shows if you fall behind by third grade, you're really unlikely to have, you know, as high of academic outcomes or catch up and graduate on time. And so if this is, you know, affecting kids at a really young age and preventing them from even having a fair shot when they're, you know, older, that's something we should pay attention to.
Joyce?
Oh, yeah, I agree totally. And, you know, here's a quote from one of the kids who was interviewed when asked, what are some of the reasons you're here? And he or she said, missing school. If you're missing school, you're not being occupied for 9 hours out of the day. So that could make you do things like drugs, smoke weed, something like that. So they're in a vicious cycle. They're out of school, and, you know, out of school suspension is unsupervised time.
At the same time, I think another thing that most of the youth seem to have in common, in addition to wanting to be heard, is just saying things like kids in juvenile probation are no different. And being concerned about, you know, I was just labeled a bad kid. One of the parts that a lot of the researchers really wanted to highlight when I was talking to them was when they asked the youths about their hopes and dreams for the future. And, you know, they had responses like be a kindergarten teacher, you know, get out of the city, be a farmer, put up drywall, be a real estate agent, own my own business. Things that really, you know, I think that Michael Yonas pointed out to me, you know, could be anyone's dreams. And it's a, you know, so the kind of the whole purpose of this is how can we actually just stop talking about this and try to work together with these different agencies and governments and department, probation, everybody to try to actually, you know, help them make these dreams possible for these children.
Right. Natasha brought up something that I want to build upon, and that was the likelihood of suspension, black students versus white students. And there was another report that was released in the fall. I believe it was funded by the FISA Foundation and the Heinz Endowments. It focused on African-American teenage girls. And it found that nationally, black girls are referred to juvenile court three times as often as white girls. But in Allegheny County, it was 11 times as often. And that's just, well, it's amazing.
It's astounding.
So where do we go from there? I mean, what are the researchers saying? I mean, they collated all this information, but they had to draw some conclusions.
One of their recommendations focused specifically on needing to pay more attention and devote more resources and programs to girls of color, even though as a whole, they make up, like in Allegheny County, they make up 26% of the population. Like you said, they're very disproportionately being represented by girls of color, and there tend to be a lot more programs out there for boys and men, young men of color. And so that was one of the recommendations in here. Some of the recommendations were somewhat, you know, a little general about forming partnerships and identifying funding and ways to do this. I think that's what researchers and the Pitzer Foundation and other folks having with parallel efforts are hoping that, okay, now moving forward, we can actually see some, you know, more actionable changes to address it.
In our remaining 2 minutes, I want to talk about any of the recommendations you'd also like to bring up. But people always say, okay, we hear recommendations. But what are the next concrete steps? So the recommendations, okay, how we do this. Here's what should be done, but how do you do it? Joyce.
Well, one thing, and I asked this of the people that I interviewed, was that same question. What's next beyond finding out what's bothering these children? And it's keeping the conversation going, having follow-up meetings between these agencies that work with children and people in the court system and the legal system. That's a major step that they need to take.
And Sasha, what did you hear about, what are the next steps beyond recommendations or implementing some of these recommendations?
I think as ongoing conversations, but also maybe, you know, probably some really strong ideas or plans for programs to tackle these areas with that maybe the Pitzer Foundation will step up to fund or other sources. It should be noted too, you know, there are parallel efforts in the region, like for instance, the Heinz Endowments, one of the major grant makers in this area, has a Just Pittsburgh movement, which is similar to Pittsburgh Foundation's 100% Pittsburgh.
Right.
So, you know, there seems to be momentum building around, okay, you know, let's really do something about this. When I say momentum, I mean the funding to back it. So I think that would be essential as well moving forward.
Right. And to that point, the Pittsburgh Foundation with this study said their entire 100% Pittsburgh initiative, they're going to look at the findings and then commit 60% of funding going forward to these groups that need help in terms of the poverty and, you know, the juvenile justice system, you know, programs that assist kids in that system.
It's probably worth mentioning that Allegheny County Rich Fitzgerald, too, has also said he was, you know, very interested in this report and wanting to do more at the government, you know, the county government level to address these issues.
All righty. Joyce Gannon is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Tribune Review. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Good Kevin. To be here.
Politics and Big Money, a new analysis that's coming up on The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're a few weeks away from the deadline for candidates wishing to appear on the May primary ballot to file their nominating petitions, but the campaign season is well underway. Joining us to talk about campaign fundraising finances is Mike Wershagen, investigative reporter for The Caucus, weekly newspaper covering state government and politics, who just published an in-depth piece exploring campaign financing and special interests. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence. And Mike, some non-sports fans might ask, is baseball season ever over? Basketball season, fill in whatever sports season, hockey season, is it ever over? So I will ask you, is campaign fundraising season ever over after your analysis of all these dollars?
No. No, it is not.
And that's the conclusion you drew from this story.
You know, I think it's something I've kind of picked up over the years covering politics, that you're never going to turn down a check. You're never going to not want to be raising money, because these things are really, really expensive. And if you don't raise this money, somebody else is going to.
Okay. Now, you did an investigation of the money raised during the 2015-16 election cycle. These are statewide campaigns, all of them?
Yes.
Okay. So we're talking...
Well, I'm sorry. Okay. I should back up there. These are... a lot of the statewide races were in there, but some of the people who are on this list are caucus leaders.
Okay.
And so they take that money and they don't spend it all on their own campaigns. They distribute it to members of their caucus who are running around the state.
Okay. All right. And the campaigns as well, but the statewide campaigns, we're talking about statewide judicial races.
Correct.
The three row offices.
The row offices, even the governor, even though he wasn't on the ballot, he was raising quite a bit of money.
And that was, of course, after he was elected and getting ready for going for a second term.
Correct.
Okay. Now, you focused on money coming from whom, and you sort of talked a little bit about it, but also going to whom?
Well, we wanted to look at money coming from political action committees. Now, these are committees that are formed under the state law that allow organizations, lobbying firms, unions, really anybody, to collect money from their members or donors or whomever, and then to distribute that money directly to campaigns. So these are not people who are running their own ads necessarily. They are just taking this money and they are transferring it directly to politicians. Automotive associations, teachers unions, all sorts of the Trial Lawyers Association.
Oh, I want to get into that. Yeah.
Okay. and so once we got the records for the total number of donations, we took a look at who were the top 10 recipients of these donations. Who are the 10 politicians who are getting the most from this?
Okay. Now, I'd like to back up just a little bit because we have to understand the law is different, is it not, for judicial candidates versus candidates for other offices and how they can reach out?
How they can reach out it is, but neither has a limit on donations. If you want to give somebody $1 million in this state, you can cut them a $1 million check. You don't have to play any games with it. But judicial candidates cannot solicit money, and they can't directly accept money. So you can't give the judge or the judicial candidate a check.
So you're running for state superior court. I can't give you a check if I want to support you.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Now, I can call you up if I'm the judge and talk about what I want to do as a judge, what my philosophy is, and then somebody else from my campaign can call up and say, wasn't that a nice guy? Wouldn't you like to give him some money? And that's...
doesn't seem like a whole lot of separation there.
Well, it depends on who you ask, and it also... sort of reliant on our faith in these individuals who are running to be judges.
Okay. But I assume that the candidate has designated that person to follow up and ask the question, hey, wouldn't you like to support that guy you just talked to?
You know, it's different for some of these candidates. The person I talked to for Justice Kevin Dougherty, who won a state Supreme Court seat, said that he doesn't get involved at all in these things. Now, I have never talked to, or I didn't talk to Kevin Dougherty about this, Justice Dougherty about this, but that's what his campaign counsel said.
Okay. Never talked to, yet he was the biggest recipient that you found?
And number two wasn't even close.
So he
Justice
received
Dougherty,
how much? 2.8?
$2.8 million. The next largest recipient was Attorney General Josh Shapiro, who took in $1.8 million. So he took in almost slightly less than $1 million more than the second place person.
And that brings us back to the Philadelphia Trial Lawyers Association,
correct,
which you alluded to earlier. And I believe they contributed to his campaign $850,000.
They contributed $850,000 to his campaign. This is the Trial Lawyers Association of Philadelphia, not of Pennsylvania. So this is just Philly trial lawyers. $850,000 to Justice Dougherty, $775,000 to Justice Donahue, and $700,000 to Justice David Wecht. Those are the three justices who won the election in 2015.
What did the president of the Trial Lawyers Association tell you? Why they're handing out so much money? Why?
Well, he said they are trying to support judges and justices who support things like open access to courts, making it who are opposed to limiting the ways that people can sue corporations or other individuals. They're also saying that they have to counter this influence that's coming in from out-of-state groups. And there is money pouring in from out-of-state groups. I mean, some of these advocacy groups have realized that you can influence state judiciaries if you start to get involved in state-level politics.
We hear that, I think, more often. At least the public hears that more often. Maybe somebody's trying to influence a U.S. Senate race or maybe a key congressional seat that is hanging in the balance, something like that. But I don't know that we hear that too often about judicial races.
We don't, but there's a lot of money flowing in there. The Brennan Center for Justice out of NYU added up the figures that they had, and they came up with the total of $20 million that was spent by outside groups on state Supreme Court races around the country. Now, that's just Supreme Court races. $20 million in 2016. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Okay. Speaking of total money, the total money that you followed, Trace, was how much?
$147 million.
Okay. I want to get back to Justice Dougherty. There was another law, another large contribution to his campaign made by a local of the IBEW, and his brother is the union chief?
Yes. Justice Kevin Dougherty's brother is John Dougherty. He is the head of the IBEW Local 98 in Philadelphia. The IBEW gave Justice Dougherty about $700,000. Now, he was not their only candidate. This union spent a lot of money during the last cycle, but that is a pretty large sum. It was enough to make the IBEW his second largest source of funds. And what's kind of interesting is that that union and his brother in particular are currently under investigation. The FBI raided his house, raided his and by his, I mean Johnny,
right?
John Dougherty.
And related to the donation or some other reason?
Well, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that this investigation is related to the union's role in the Philadelphia mayor's race and Justice Dougherty's race. Now, I have not confirmed that, and they were relying on anonymous sources. So,
okay. But everything else, all those dollars you were telling us, they were all done legally, though, right?
Correct, yeah. Right.
But it's still a lot of money.
It is an awful lot of money.
Right.
And that's sort of the way the law is structured here. The basic premise behind it is there's no limit on donations, but there's supposed to be transparency so that you can give as much as you want, but you got to put your name on that check. And we have to be able to figure out where that money is coming from.
Speaking of which, did you have any trouble? It was just obviously a lot of work getting this, but did you have any trouble getting at all this data?
You know, it's not the easiest thing to do when you're trying to look at aggregates. You have to take a step back at the raw data. You have to process it through a bunch of different computer programs, and it's a long, kind of convoluted process. But the data is there.
Okay, Mike, we have just a minute left, and I want to get to you. Whenever anything, maybe controversial comes up about judicial elections, this came. In this case, a lot of money poured into judicial races, merit selection comes in. That was also part of your article that you did for the caucus. So, I mean, is there any chance that merit selection is going to come into this?
Well, I mean, it's always there. You're always going to have people who are supporting the idea of trying to get this to happen. And, you know, I'm not sure if it's actually going to make it, you know, to make it to a floor vote at any point in this session. But I would bet that you're going to see somebody bring up this in the form of some kind of legislation.
All righty. Mike Wershagen is an investigative reporter for the caucus, which covers state government and politics. Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and now it's time for an update. 2 weeks ago on the Confluence, we told you about a private report done for UPMC that was released about how transplant patients in Pittsburgh contracted mold infections. Five patients died between October 2014, July 2016. Lawsuits filed, two settled. This week, new information was revealed, and we welcome back Ben Schmidt of the Tribune Review, who's been following this story since the beginning. Ben, if you would, a brief recap as to the cause of the mold infection. There's a disagreement between the CDC and the expert hired by UPMC, right?
Yeah, that's true. There's been a new report that surfaced that pointed to possibly linens that are supplied to UPMC as a source. The CDC and the State Department of Health have not signed off on that as a cause.
And that linen company is from Dubois, right?
Yes, Paris Healthcare Linens.
Okay, so the new information this week. So was this another death, or did we already know about this death, and it was the family got around to filing a lawsuit? Or is this now a new death related to it?
Yeah, there's a few moving parts here. There's a new death that we did not know about. It's a man who died in October, and it's at a different hospital, UPMC Shadyside. All the other cases have been either UPMC Presbyterian or UPMC Montefiore.
Okay, so a new hospital, another death, that would mean six deaths at three different hospitals?
That's correct. There's six. And what is noteworthy about this death is this is the first patient who was not a transplant patient. He had leukemia. He's still immune suppressed, and that's part of UPMC's defense in this.
Okay. As you followed up on this, UPMC saying anything about this death? And do we know anything more about the linen, hospital linen service?
Well, there's still the debate. The underlying debate is this a problem for UPMC, or is it a byproduct of what they describe as treating the sickest of the sick, people with compromised immune systems? So that's still there, you know, the way that they react to this. As far as the linen company, they're also denying that they did anything wrong, and UPMC continues to contract with them.
Okay. There is still, in addition to this new lawsuit, there's still a couple others pending?
The lawyers involved have said that, first of all, there's two others pending. So there's three total, two have settled. And now the lawyers say they're going to bring more. We usually don't like to report that until they actually do so, but they even put it in this latest lawsuit that they have at least one more.
Okay. Now, 2 weeks ago when you were in this studio, I asked you, okay, what did the CDC, what did the Pennsylvania Department of Health say after this report, private report contracted for UPMC by this hospital environment specialist from the University of Minnesota, and basically pointed to mold, hospital linens, and you said, no, they're not going to follow it up. Now, anything new from this new information?
And I'll say the same thing. They say no big deal. This report doesn't mean anything. They're not opening up any new investigation.
And that is based on this new information this week.
Even now, and the lawyers for these plaintiffs are pleading for the CDC to come, but that's not happening so far.
Can the State Department of Health step in and say, well, you know, there's something for us to look at?
Oh, absolutely they could, and I think they'd be the ones to invite the CDC, but so far neither side has done that.
All righty. Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it. Ben Schmidt is a reporter for the Tribune Review.
Thank you.
Finally, one other update for you. Last week, we talked about two Democratic challenges for Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. Only one challenger plus Peduto filed and submitted the $10,000 necessary to be considered for the Democratic endorsement, Councilwoman Darlene Harris. Reverend John Welsh opted not to seek the party endorsement, but he is still running for the office. And by the way, we'll speak with Reverend Welsh next Wednesday during Morning Edition. For this week, that's The Confluence. The engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.